This week on Potlatch, Mary Jane Fate of Rampart has an urgent message for Alaska Natives, and Lino Burrell of Juneau comments on Tlingit culture. Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives. John Angayak, whom we heard last week in English, this week in Yupik. October 21st through the 23rd, delegates from Interior Alaska attended the Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. One delegate to this conference, Mary Jane Fate of Rampart, delivered to all Alaska Natives this message.
Last month, September the 20th, 1974, Congress has created a new law for the Johnson-O'Malley programs throughout the United States. This law is now in effect, and there are some provisions in there that we must act on, and we must act immediately. I am one of the review committee members from the Tanana Chief region. There are 12 on the committee of the Johnson-O'Malley review monies. And the important things is, number one, we have to establish a real parent Native committee. It's got to be grassroots. It's got to be the target area in the communities affected. These real parent committees must do the planning, developmental work, evaluating and monitoring all administration monies and programs of Johnson-O'Malley funds. Johnson-O'Malley funds go for special needs of Indian children in education throughout the state. It must go to state-operated schools, Native groups, not BIA or private schools. This year, the monies are open to all Indians with one-quarter Indian blood or more. This is throughout the whole United States. Years ago and last year, there was $26 million in the budget for the Indians, but it was on non-taxable Indian-owned land. that the students got this money. Now it's open. So therefore, it was suggested that there be an increase in Congress of this budget to ensure programs to go where it should go. Also, since this is open to one quarter or more Indian, the majority of the money can go to larger communities where the majority of the students are. We need a further clarification on this. For instance, would it be best where the needs are, where the money should go? The BIA, our area director, has advised that these education committees be of real parents. They should be nominated, selected, and served by the procedures determined by the Indian communities affected. There should be priorities or some kind of education plan made. It should come from the village, the sub-region, the region, and a state plan for the education of our students under the Johnson O'Malley. In the past, we got $4.6 million in the state of Alaska to be distributed to the applicants. This year, we got $1 million more. There's $500,000 right now that should be distributed where the needs are in Juneau. In the past, we had this 12-member review committee established, from one from each geographical region. It is now open. Should we have this committee in the future? If not, should there be sub-region committees? If not this, should there be village committees to determine where this money should go? Keep in mind that this is Johnson O'Malley money is financial assistance to meet special educational needs of Indian children. If we start establishing, let's say, 12 review committees, of which maybe there's six or more on each review committee, times about four or five meetings a year, travel, per diem, all kinds of other expenses, we'll be throwing our money into places where it will be not be meeting the needs. So we must keep administration costs as low as possible. The money should go to where the needs are in education. A new application form and Johnson O'Malley program guidelines has been prepared, and these should be requested from the JOMAFN office in Anchorage, or any type of questions or information should be directed to Ralph Iluska, the director of the Johnson O'Malley AFN committee. Deadline date to submit proposals is January 15, 1975, and this should be they should receive this prior in case there's any negotiating or updating or anything deleted. We have asked each of our nonprofit associations to disseminate information to all groups, school districts, and segments of the urban areas surrounding the association and rural. This is to get information to the village coordinators, to the real parents, to what they want in education. I really think that the village people, the real parents, and the school board with the administration should get together and show what their needs are, which is different from any other area. You know your area better than any of us, and it should come from you, and therefore submit this, I feel, to sub-region on into our regional presidents, and start with a whole plan on priorities. Since this is being requested, we've got to do it, and we should do it as soon as possible. I think now Tanana Chiefs, I would say, definitely send it into Melvin Charlie, president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. And if you know your sub-regional person, you see him more often, you could direct it to him, he would direct it on into your president, and then right on into maybe a copy to AFNJO staff Ralph Iluska in Anchorage.
That was Mary Jane Fate of Rampart. Thanks to the University of Washington Press, the Alaska Festival of Music, Lorraine Caranda, and the performers, we can present the following Alaskan Eskimo songs and stories, beginning with Lady Shaman's Spear Song. The shaman, or medicine man, Angatkok, no longer practices his magic art among Alaskan Eskimos, But in the past, he was a person greatly to be respected, admired, or feared. The shaman was quite often a person of wealth, for he received many gifts and exacted many fees for curing illness, controlling weather, and hunting, or driving out some evil spirit. But the shaman was also feared for his power to cast an evil spell or bring misfortune upon an enemy. Therefore, his position in the community was not always an enviable one. In some ways, the shaman's life was one of danger. He could be accused by a rival shaman of having caused the illness or misfortune of a villager. Thus, he might become an object of revenge. Threats upon a shaman's life were not uncommon. For this reason, a shaman might come to his calling or profession somewhat reluctantly. Why or how did a man become a shaman or a woman become a shaman? Some shamans had a handicap or disability that set them apart from the community. If a young boy was unable to hunt, the most important activity for a male, he might become isolated and withdrawn from others. He might take refuge in a dream world. Having unusual dreams and visions was an indication of shamanistic qualities. If a young person had a relative who was a shaman or seemed to possess unusual talent for inducing dreamlike or trance-like states, he would be considered a likely successor to the older shaman and would become apprenticed to him. Very important to the shamans were the drum songs that they composed for rituals, for good fortune in the hunt, and for curing. Drumming and singing seemed to have been a part of every shamanistic performance. As one shaman told an investigator, the shaman's drum represented the world. By means of this drum, he traveled all over the world. As he performed, the shaman entered a self-induced hypnotic or trance-like state, and his songs were likely to affect his audience similarly. The shaman would tremble and speak to the spirits. Sometimes the audience would hear the spirits answering the shaman. If they did, it was likely that the shaman was using ventriloquism. In the darkened kasigi, the shaman performed sleight of hand, such as escaping from binding sinews or thongs, or transporting himself from one side of the kasigi to another after he had been tied up. One very old Eskimo told of an especially powerful shaman who drummed, sang, and then proved his magic power by stabbing himself in the abdomen, with much blood flowing, to prove the severity of the wound. Then, before the eyes of his astounded audience, the shaman completely healed the wound by calling on the spirits. No scar was visible. John Olana of King Island tells of a famous woman shaman who, during a ritual dance in the kasigi, grabbed a spear from a dancer, stabbed herself, and fell to the floor with blood pouring from the wound. She got up, staggered toward the entrance, and fell dead in the entryway. The people were terrified, and they wanted her to come back, so they sang her own song, and she returned to life. Shamans often used archaic words or made up their own special language, and the text of the song, the Lady Shaman Spear Song, is vague. It is interpreted as meaning, "How is it? What have I here? A sharp implement, a spear, I stab myself." That this song had great magic power is proven by the fact that the dead shamaness returned to life when the spectators sang it to her. The shaman's songs and drumming were of great importance in his performance, but he also relied upon the magic power of charms or amulets. Almost any object, a carved animal image, a bone, a feather, a shell, an unusual rock, or anything the shaman chose might become an amulet. A song or charm could be sold or given by the shaman and could be inherited from the one who possessed it. Unless the buyer paid the price agreed upon, the song or amulet would lose its power, or the song would be forgotten. This happened a number of times, according to an informant from Kotzebue. The informant did not explain whether he had been a buyer or seller in such a transaction. The shaman's charms aided him in effecting cures and performing magic feats. A very old shaman song from King Island, sung by John Olana, describes the special charm that brings the shaman his power. It is the rock with a hole in it, which he wears on a string around his neck. One of the cleverest of the shaman's tricks was his ability to travel under the ocean ice, to return later with tales of the villages or mythical world he had seen beneath the surface. There can be no doubt that shamans were able to place themselves or others safely under the ice, and that their disappearance and return were witnessed. One elderly Eskimo woman from Bethel said that the story of a great shaman's ice act, when the bladder feast was over, the Angatkok brought a boy to the shore ice and said that he would put the boy under the ice. The boy would come back, he said, from a journey under the ice. The Angatkok put that boy under the ice. I saw him do it. After 3 days, we saw the boy come up out of the ice. He was dry and unharmed. That was a great Angatkok. The Angatkok's secret was his knowledge of conditions along the shore. Thick ice had formed along the bank, and at low tide there was no water beneath it. Thus, it would be perfectly safe to use such an ice cave in the performance of his magic. Marriage to a shaman or to a shaman's close relative was considered unwise. Therefore, a young girl who had shamanistic powers might wish to be rid of them in order to attract a young man of her choice. Joe Seaton of Hooper Bay sings a song composed by a shaman girl to help rid herself of her shamanistic power so that she would not frighten away her betrothed. It must have been quite effective, for she subsequently married the young man and gave up her practice of magic. The words, as in many shaman songs, are without specific meaning. When the Christian missionaries came to Eskimo villages, they largely opposed the shaman's practices and claims to supernatural power. As the Eskimos were converted to Christianity, their faith and belief in the Angatkok diminished. One might believe that in the past the shaman had performed these magic feats and had powerful contact with the spirit world, but for most Eskimos, shamanism was no longer acceptable as a source of supernatural power. As contact with non-Eskimos increased, the Eskimos found it less and less important to ask the shaman's help in curing. The missionaries brought medical aid. The shaman's influence in the hunt was less effective than were modern firearms. Finally, the shaman retained his importance only as an authority on the old rituals and taboos, a few of which still survive. But the old Eskimos who recall the performance of an Angatkok are still convinced that he performed his magic through the mysterious powers that he possessed. Typical of the stories that are told about a shaman of long ago is one that Paul Green tells about his great-grandfather, Ikenik. The Shaman Who Went to the Moon. Ikenik was a medicine man in Kotzebue. He had some special kind of power, and he did all kinds of tricks by his powers. One time, when he was up on the Noatak River, he saw the new moon come out. Ikenik wished to go up to the moon, so he did it by his doctoring, or power. He was acting inside the house. They saw his body moving, but he wouldn't speak anymore. They couldn't understand or hear what he said. So in this way, his spirit left his body and went to the moon. When his spirit came back to his body again, Ikenik told the people what he had seen. He said that he saw another medicine man up there in the moon. They met and talked. It was the Angatkok, Ashuchuk, from Point Hope. Ikenik's grandchildren didn't believe him. His nephew didn't believe him. They thought he was just acting funny and trying to make believe he had been to the moon. One of Ikenik's grandsons, Nusuk, waited until the Point Hope people came to visit Kotzebue in the springtime, then had his wife invite the Point Hopers to his tent for a big meal. The Point Hopers had brought muktuk to Nusuk. After they had finished eating, Nusuk asked, "Did anybody from Point Hope go up to the moon when the moon was new? Did one of your medicine men go up to the moon?" One of the old men from Point Hope answered, "Yes, there was a fellow from Point Hope went up to the moon at that time. When he came back, he told us he had seen Ikenik up there in the moon. They met together." So the moon was explored by the two medicine men in early days ago. They went up by their doctoring, by their power.
Ah, yeah, Can you hear?
That was the Lady Shaman Spear song and rock with a hole in it by John Wolana of Point Hope, and the Shaman Girls song by Joe Seaton of Hooper Bay.
Unasu umyoknaji programmerji bigaji. Janik Nijugufji Igaranarachputwani, KUAC, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Many of our listeners can watch Potlatch's television equivalent, the Alaska Native Magazine. Like Potlatch, Alaska Native Magazine depends on the advice and direction of Alaska Natives. One advisor to the television program, Lino Burrell of Juneau, came to the radio studios on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus recently, and I cornered him for an interview.
Well, I'm a Tlingit Indian from Juneau, Alaska. I was born in Juneau, raised in Juneau, and went to school through grades 1 through 8 through the BIA schools. My secondary education was in Juneau High School. Shortly after that, I went south to Seattle University for one short semester and then into the armed services. I served 4 years with the U.S. Air Force in Germany, came back home and married the girl that I've been, well, you might call her a childhood sweetheart. We've been went together for quite a few years, even before I went in the service. Shortly after that, we moved south so we could both continue our education. We had two of our children born in Juneau and two in Camel, California. We lived in California for 15 years while I went through various night classes at the San Jose City College, and I worked during the day for More Business Forms as a pressman. Shortly, or after we'd lived in California about 11 years, I decided to get out of the printing business, and I went to radio and television school and on my own, and opened up my own shop in California. We've really didn't care for the traffic. It seemed like everything was just kind of, you know, getting, the county was just getting too heavily populated. So we decided we'd move back up to Alaska, where we could teach our children our culture. We found that living in California, they were slowly, you know, losing their identity as what they were, where they came from. And to me, these are very important parts of anybody. You have to have this sense of where you've come from to know, really know where you're going in the future. We brought our children back, and happy to say they've adapted to the Juneau life of rain and snow and everything else like that quite readily. My daughter is one of the young gay song dancers. It's a Tlingit dancing group in Juneau. And we're very, very proud of her for, you know, her accomplishments. And that's just about it. After I came back from the States, I went to work for the Department of Labor as a manpower specialist. I ran my own project shortly after that as director of the Family Service Center, a social service project. And after that research and demonstration project was over, I went to work for the governor's office as utilization manager in the Office of Telecommunications. Our culture has been, how do you put it, been put down, been suppressed. We're told that we have to learn to be something other than what we actually feel inside. Do I make myself clear? You know, we're torn between what we were and what people are trying to make us out to be. And I feel that the transition to the thing has to be the culture. The bridge that gaps between what we have been and what we are is our culture. And I strongly feel that, you know, a lot of the problems that the Alaska Natives have had in the past, as far as the inability to bridge that culture, has been because there's really nothing to hang on to. There is nothing that a person can carry with him and give him that strength to bridge that gap. Many years ago, when we were told that we had to suppress our culture and learn another culture, we were also taught, you know, that our art forms, the carvings, the beadwork, the basket weaving, and these things were things that were trinkets that could be sold, you know, to tourists and things like that. And it wasn't until very lately, that, you know, our own art form came into being as something that we can put in a museum or someplace or in an art gallery. And I think this is also a very important part of our transition into, you know, the Western culture.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau, KOTZ Kotzebue, and KYUK Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.